Welcome back to the Israel Connection, Joseph Browdy.
Thanks. Nice to be with you again, Dave.
So there's currently no independent Western media able to report from the embattled enclave of Gaza. Only a handful of Arabic news outlets are now present in the Strip, but their reporters are, in the best case, unable to provide objective coverage of events. And in the worst case, they are complicit with Hamas. Testimonies from real-life Gazans are therefore crucially important at this time to get a more complete picture of the reality on the ground. Your Voices from Gaza project is a continuation of Whispered in Gaza, a series of interviews with Gazans collected by your organization, the Center for Peace Communications, which has compiled short animated video clips with poignant first-hand accounts of Gazan residents' day-to-day life under Hamas's tyranny. Do you want to explain what is the aim of your Voices from Gaza project in greater detail?
Yes. As I've written, in territories in the region where terror militias rule, we believe it's important not only to listen to the voices that hold the megaphone, but also to hear from the majorities who are forced to whisper. There are majorities in all of the territories dominated by Iran in this region, from Yemen and Syria to Lebanon and Gaza, majorities of the population that do not want to be ruled by Iranian proxies or the likes of Hamas and want a different future. But they have found no way to express their aspirations to the international community, while proxies of Hamas, like Al Jazeera, platform the group's leaders and shills. Hamas enforcers, meanwhile, intimidate and forcibly repress all dissident voices and have been doing for 17 years. So we decided to try to help Gazans who oppose Hamas break that information monopoly. And we did so by interviewing men and women of all ages from across the Strip, hearing them tell their stories of life under Hamas rule. They described heart-rending stories of a mafia-like system that is generous to the families of its own stalwarts, but really almost traffics in the suffering of the majority of the Gazan population. And we looked for a way to safely elevate these voices. Initially, we did so through the medium of animation. We promised these people that we would not reveal their names or show their faces. And we sought to turn that into a kind of an asset by bringing together a team of animators, illustrators, and musicians to render visually the stories those voices told in a way that would enable you, while not seeing their faces, to, in a sense, inhabit their lives. And that became a series of 25 short animated clips called Whispered in Gaza. We translated it into 7 languages. We released it through media partnerships all over the world, from Latin America and North America to Europe and the Middle East. And in the region, our distribution partner in Arabic was Al Arabiya, which is one of the largest media outlets in the Arabic language. It was something that enabled Arab viewers for the first time ever to hear from Gazans unfiltered. And what they learned from these voices was that Hamas is not a group of heroes, as Al Jazeera strives to portray them, but really more of a drab and brutal authoritarian system, much like the sort of thuggish regimes that so many other Arabs suffer from every day.
I just want to make one thing, our listeners aware of one thing that they need to appreciate, that it's a very difficult task of gathering the testimonies from Gazans, because often it's on the condition of anonymity, as speaking out against Hamas can be extremely dangerous, you would say.
Yes, indeed. Opposition to Hamas has manifested in very poignant ways over the years. Notably, in 2019, 1,000 Gazans waged anti-Hamas street demonstrations. In doing so, they not only braved gunfire, prison, and torture, they also exposed their own families to collective punishment for their having shown the courage to call for a different future for Gaza. The fear is real, and it continues to this moment, because as I've said and written in the past, Gazans are not convinced yet that Hamas is about to be unseated. They fear that the outcome of the present war will be similar to that of the four wars that preceded it, which is essentially a brokered ceasefire that ends with Hamas effectively in place.
So I'm hearing some views that because people are believing that Hamas can't be eliminated, that Israel continuing its war in Gaza is really a terrible exercise, because all that will occur is the death of more innocent civilians, people are saying.
The Gazans we are hearing from and platforming are saying is that for the tragedy, the scale of the tragedy that we're seeing today, it's incomparable with the wars that preceded it in Gaza. It will be that much more tragic and utterly unbearable if it ends with Hamas in place. In other words, what they're asking is, what is the point of all of this if it isn't going to lead to the upending of the Hamas government structure?
So let's get into some revelations from your latest project, Voices from Gaza, and perhaps some other accounts that are feeding from other places. You alluded to Hamas, anti-Hamas street protests back in 2019, and a fellow by the name of Mumin al-Natour organized or co-organized these street protests. Do you want to tell us something about his story?
Mumin al-Natour is a lawyer in Gaza, a young man who indeed co-organized the anti-Hamas street demonstrations. Those demonstrations adopted the banner, "We Want to Live, Bidna Naish." It was a repudiation of the Hamas claim that Palestinians love death. So they said, "We want to live." Natour was imprisoned 20 times over the years since then by Hamas for organizing those demonstrations and attempting to organize new ones. Gazans took to the streets again as recently as July 30th of last year. And now he's among the Palestinians who are trying to find ways to get humanitarian aid to the people who need it without it being siphoned off by Hamas, as there are estimates that as much as 60% of the food aid that is brought in from international donors is taken by Hamas. They use it first to feed their stalwarts, and second, they use it as a form of money, essentially. Bags of aid that are marked not for resale, clearly marked that they're intended to be distributed free to the people who need it, are sold in the markets of Gaza by merchants who are forced to pay for it and then resell it. And that is essentially serving Hamas as a form of financial injection to its war machine. And Mumin is one of the people who understands that and has been trying to find ways to distribute aid directly to the Gazans who need it.
His organization is called the Palestinian Youth for Development, I understand.
Yes.
Another case is the one of Mohammed Mushtaha, a mosque preacher in the Gaza City neighborhood of Shejaiya. Tell us his story, please, Joseph.
And this is one of the many pieces and videos as well that came out through the Free Press, our distribution partner in the United States for the new series Voices from Gaza. Mohammed Mushtaha is a mosque preacher who has been a mosque preacher for many years in Shujaiya, very well liked, and he is not a Hamas stalwart. Generally, the people in the religious establishment who are not ideologues of Hamas, you never hear about them outside of Gaza, because they don't make those kinds of blood-curdling statements that find their way in translation into the outside world through the likes of memory, right? They simply keep their heads down. But in this instance, Mushtaha was ordered by Hamas to give a pro-Hamas sermon to an audience of several thousand Gazans who were sheltering in a school. And he refused to do it. And for refusing to do so, he was abducted by Hamas, and his family feared that he would be killed. Now, we were in touch with his son and talked about the options that they had, and they made the agonizing choice, and it's impossible to know what to do really in situations like this, but their calculation was that it would be better to tell his story to the world than to be silent and simply hope that he would be freed. This rather harrowing account by his son of his own father's abduction was published in the Free Press. It led to his release. 2 days after the piece was published, Hamas let the cleric go. I think that the story is important because it points to the existence of a cadre, some subset of religious leaders in Gaza who differ with Hamas, at least in some key ways, and who would be in a position to argue differently about what Islam brings to bear in questions of the future of Gaza. And so we consider it important to give a voice, give a platform to people like that who take this sort of brave stand.
Yes, absolutely. Now, I shared with you another article, which was in Haaretz, by a Gazan who called himself Abdullah to protect himself. He's anti-Hamas. But what astounded me in that particular instance was the comments that were there that slammed this guy as just being another mouthpiece for pro-Israel propaganda. What do you make of this account that was published by Haaretz, which, of course, wouldn't normally put stuff out that is considered to be too right-wing?
Well, what we find when we put these voices up, the likes of the kind of voice that you're describing, is that it's inconvenient to people both on the far left and the far right. It doesn't fit their narrative. And their first instinct when they hear a voice that doesn't conform to their narrative, in the past, when we had a more civil culture of discourse in much of the world, when we heard something that didn't fit our narrative, we would grapple with it. We would debate it, engage it, etc. But today, people's instinct is to say, oh, that must be a lie because it's inconsistent with what I believe. So in our case, we've seen people on the far left respond to the many voices within Gaza that oppose Hamas by claiming that that's impossible. These couldn't really be Gazans. Surely all Gazans agree with Hamas. How could anyone in Gaza express or believe something other than what Hamas says without being some kind of a paid Israeli agent? Even though opinion polling, and I know you'd like to get into that later, has consistently shown majorities of Gaza opposed to Hamas governing their territory. We've also seen objections on the far right to this testimony because it doesn't conform to their claims that, in their words, there are no innocent people in Gaza. In other words, there's a school of thought that all Gazans are in some ways complicit with Hamas. That's patently false. And it's certainly unhelpful to anyone who aspires to see decent self-rule in Gaza in the future. Undoubtedly, that type of self-rule will hinge on identifying and empowering Gazan elements that oppose Hamas. And yet these extreme voices don't want to hear or see any venture that humanizes Palestinians in Gaza who want a different future.
One article that I came across, Joseph, which really is very revealing, was one coming from a Syrian journalist, Manar al-Sharif, who told Times of Israel how life under Hamas is like being under ISIS, and the majority of Gazans don't back this terror group. Would you tell us a little bit about what happened with her? She moved to Gaza, apparently, to study there, but things didn't quite work out for her.
Yes, Manar Sharif is one of the very brave young people who came together in what they called the Gaza Youth Committees several years ago to create educational projects designed to foster resiliency and so on among Gazan youth. And among the things that they did was to organize a series of Zoom encounters with Israeli peace activists. And they did this publicly. And Manar and several others who were among the organizers of this on the Gazan side were jailed by Hamas for having so much as spoken with Israeli civilians. They were eventually released, and Manar now lives safely outside Gaza, enabling her to be among the voices that shines a light on all of this.
One story that I find absolutely extraordinary, and I've watched the video account that's produced by Prague University CEO Marissa Streit. This is the story of Dor Shachar, who changed his name to that. He warns the world in no uncertain terms about the evil of Hamas. He grew up in Gaza, suffered a horrific childhood. If you watch the video, he talks about standing in the street when he was a seven-year-old boy, seeing heads rolling down the street from people who must have been decapitated at the time of the conflict between Fatah and Hamas. And he has personal experiences in a Palestinian jail before moving to Israel and converting to Judaism. His harrowing account is absolutely amazing, giving a glimpse into the reality of what life is like for people in Gaza. Do you know any more about Dor Shachar? He's been in Israel now for a little while. He is not a new story necessarily.
Yes, I've followed that story and seen the interview you're referring to. While, of course, most Gazans don't, their life path doesn't follow his, you know, to the extent that you described. But within Gaza, there are many who remain there and see themselves as bound inextricably to that land, and who identify as Palestinians, as Muslims, and so on, and very proud to be so, and may also be seriously at odds with Israel, yet oppose Hamas's brand of what it calls resistance because it is so self-destructive, because it doesn't attain Palestinian national aspirations. It's about starting wars one can't win while hiding in bunkers, leaving civilians to suffer the casualties, and stealing money and food intended from the outside world to go to ordinary Gazans, but instead that really pads the pockets of Hamas leaders and their families who live in opulence in Qatar and Turkey while the population suffers. That's what the majority of Gazans oppose. And those are the kinds of people we're primarily focused on reaching and engaging.
And just one other thing, one other little anecdote from that account of Dor Shachar. When he grew up, his father said that the Israelis have got three legs. They're very evil people. He didn't talk about horns for some reason. He talked about having three legs. He, at the time when it was easy to go into Israel to work, managed to go there, and he just walked behind some Israelis just to see what really was the situation. And of course, he found out that Israelis are just like anybody else, bearing two legs. What a such an amazing lie that his father put on his own son.
Indeed, the dehumanization of the other is, of course, a mainstay of messaging in Gazan media, mosques, and schools, as engineered by Hamas over this past generation. The impact of that on the cultural sensibilities of the Strip has been profound. It's something that won't be easily addressed. It will take tremendous time and proactive effort to bring a sense of decency within the schools and the mosques and the public communications platforms of Gaza. Not to replace one form of brainwashing with another per se, but simply to tell the truth, to enable Gazans to communicate with their Israeli neighbors and with the outside world. And, of course, to enable Gazans to think for themselves, to foster critical thinking enabling them to question what they are being told by their leaders and by the sources of information that surround them.
Now, you've already intimated that you're in cooperation with Barry Weiss's mouthpiece, The Free Press, with regards to your Voices from Gaza project. Do you want to tell us how that cooperation is working with Barry Weiss?
The Free Press, Barry Weiss's publication, is taking off really here in the United States. And it was after October 7th that we were in touch with them about the idea of joining hands to bring out new testimony from Gazans amid the unfolding war that would enable Gazans to describe their own predicament to an international audience. So we had the network that we had developed, the human network within Gaza, honed through the Whispered in Gaza project. And the Free Press has a wonderful distribution platform and is very effective in getting the message out on social media and legacy media. And we've worked together in what is effectively a co-production called Voices from Gaza that has to date released 16 pieces of testimony from Gazans post October 7th.
You say that the testimony of civilians in Gaza contradicts both the extreme left perception that the terror group's murderous resistance is an expression of the will of the Palestinian people and the idea held by some on the far right that there are no innocent people in Gaza and everyone is affiliated in one way or another with the terror group. And nonetheless, polls administered by the renowned pollster Khalil Shikaki, Professor of Political Science and Director of the Palestinian Center for Policy and Survey Research in Ramallah, apparently show a rise in support for Hamas following the October the 7th atrocity. Furthermore, despite the ensuing devastation, 57% of respondents in Gaza and 82% in the West Bank believe Hamas was correct in launching the October attack, the poll indicated. A large majority believed Hamas's claims that it acted to defend a major Islamic shrine in Jerusalem against Jewish extremists and win the release of Palestinian prisoners. Only 10% said that they believed Hamas has committed war crimes, with a large majority saying that they did not see videos showing the militants committing any atrocities. What do you make of these depressing numbers, Joseph?
Well, to begin with, the same polling has shown nearly 70% of Gazans told that they do not feel free to express their actual opinions. So in an environment where the majority of Gazans have fear about even responding to an opinion poll, the fact that 10% of respondents said that they believe that Hamas was perpetrating war crimes is a quite significant number, and it reflects a larger number that would have been more reluctant to say something like that to a pollster over the phone. There are seemingly contradictory data points in these polls, and now I'm talking not only about the recent ones, but also ones going back a long way, that are actually quite easy to reconcile when you look at the minutiae of the questions and the data. Majorities of Gazans consistently say that they oppose Hamas as a governing actor in Gaza. When they do that, they're talking about the corruption, the dictatorial sort of tyrannical style of governance, and the failure of the Hamas governing structure to deliver on their basic needs. So that is a solid majority that we've seen before and after October 7th. Of Gazan opposition to Hamas as a governing actor. Now, some people might confuse that to think that, oh, that somehow means that since they're anti-Hamas, they're pro-Israel or something like that. By no means, it's of course entirely possible to be anti-Hamas and anti-Israel at the same time. And so a great many Gazans, as is reflected in these polls, believe in the idea of resistance in the abstract, yet oppose Hamas's brand of resistance for being essentially self-destructive. Another kernel of truth in what you relayed is the vast disparity between public opinion in the West Bank and public opinion in Gaza. In sum, both populations are very unhappy with their own rulers. So what you find in Gaza is that people oppose Hamas as a governing actor and would rather be ruled by the Palestinian Authority. And what you find in the West Bank is they oppose the PA as a governing actor and would rather be ruled by Hamas. That is the nature of the situation there. And in some ways mirrors the trend in much of the region of populations that are unhappy with their rulers for a range of recurring reasons that have to do with simply failure to govern decently, justly, and fairly.
I'm hoping that something like Voices from Gaza, this is one of the reasons that we're speaking, to give people greater realization of the situation, and that your efforts reach a kind of crescendo, which will see us getting some hope that Hamas's hateful ideology won't actually survive this current war.
Well, I think that it's possible to defeat Hamas, and you've noted that it's not only about defeating them militarily, it's about defeating them as a military force, as a governing actor, and as an ideology. It's possible to achieve one or two, but not three, not all three of those goals. I think that the first goal is, while difficult, is the easiest. The second goal, ending Hamas as a governing actor, is also possible within the medium term. And it's a longer term struggle to defeat Hamas ideologically. It's a generational struggle. And that's being optimistic, because if it took a generation, if Hamas had the whole of Gaza in its clutches for a generation, it would be a similarly sustained effort that would be required to reorient all of these same institutions that have been inculcating Hamas ideals for all these years, to get them to teach deep moderation, tolerance, coexistence, critical thinking, etc. That is not an easy thing to do, but ultimately it is the only true safeguard against a resurgence of Hamas in one form or another over time.
Joseph, the world has seen a terrible incident only a few days ago when hundreds of Gazans swarmed over a convoy of food aid that was being escorted by Israeli forces in northern Gaza, and many were killed in the rush. Of course, we've seen many of the media blaming Israel for shooting the people who were there grabbing food from the trucks. What information have you gleaned about how Hamas has itself been pillaging aid deliveries? This is not an isolated incident, and taking their contents for their own nefarious purposes.
We've seen and heard from Gazans, of course, long before October 7th, but in our interviewing of Gazans nearly every day since October 7th, that is a recurring point that they make, that the aid that is intended, both food and medicine, that is intended for Gazans writ large, goes to Gazans who support Hamas, who are part of Hamas's core constituency only. And what is left is sold to merchants at jacked up prices, food that is meant and marked as not for sale, meant to be given away for free to the needy, is instead sold at a premium at prices that many cannot afford. And the sale there is a form of effectively a form of military aid to Hamas, because that is what it accomplishes with those monies. It's a serious problem. There have been estimates that as much as 60% of food aid is siphoned off by Hamas in that way. That is the desperation that you see there is not for a lack of generosity on the part of the international community, not for a lack of willingness on Israel's part to foster the movement of the aid across the border into Gaza. The problem is in the distribution. The problem is in Hamas dominance of the distribution mechanisms. And now a struggle as Israel attempts to facilitate an alternative means of delivering food to the people who need it. apparently in partnership with local Gazans who are not affiliated with Hamas.
That's because there has been some criticism that Israel really isn't in the business of doing this kind of work of delivering aid into a war zone like this, and shouldn't be having the task of doing this. But of course, Israel is controlling the Gaza Strip and is really the only force able to ensure that these kinds of deliveries actually get to their target point.
Well, it has no choice but to play this role, in as much as it is committed to the defeat of Hamas. It can't do it in a way that, to begin with, the acquiescence to the Hamas dominance of food distribution is in effect allowing Hamas to fuel itself by using food as money. For that reason, it can't allow that to continue. And of course, for the purely moral reason that, as we are showing, and as others, the voices that you've raised have shown, there are a whole lot of Gazans who don't want to be ruled by Hamas. They are the best hope for a better future, both within Gaza and in terms of the possibility of some sort of accommodation between Gazans and Israelis. And so you have to find a way to ensure that they get the food that they need, even during this war. Now, there are Israelis who are unhappy, understandably, because efforts to get medication to Israeli hostages in Gaza that have not succeeded. It is unclear whether Hamas has even granted those medications to its captives. And so there are emotions about this that are understandable. At the same time, it's both a moral imperative and a strategic necessity, because Hamas uses food as money to fuel its military enterprise.
The initial problem is that the aid organizations don't see that operating in Gaza is safe and secure. So a number of them have actually capitulated, which puts even more pressure on Israel, because the humanitarian situation becomes even more dire, because these aid organizations are not operating as they should.
Well, this relates to the problem of UNRWA, which is a whole departure that we could get into. But there's an aspiration to see UNRWA replaced by the UN bodies that handle humanitarian distribution in nearly every other war-torn environment. And the case has been made that, in light of the participation of a small number of UNRWA employees in the October 7th atrocities, and the presence of a much larger number of Hamas operatives among the roster of UNRWA employees, it's simply something that that can't go on like this, because it's unlike any other UN body in its structure, in its ideology, and in the harm that it's done to Gazans themselves, and not to mention the unspeakable atrocity that some of its members participated in against Israelis.
Yeah, there's a great effort here in Australia to restore funding to UNRWA, with the claim that it's the only organisation that can really deliver aid to the people in Gaza at the present time. I don't know if that is really the case, whether other organisations could step up to the plate. What do you say? Is it possible to take UNRWA out of the picture at this time?
Well, I think that the onus is now on those who are making this case to replace UNRWA. Indeed, the onus is on those elements, including Israel and its allies, to forge an alternative. And that's why this issue that we were talking about of alternative supply, humanitarian distribution mechanisms, is so important.
How many of the people you've spoken to say that the murder, rape, and abduction on October the 7th violated Islam and is an immoral act, or do they just consider that it was bad strategy by Hamas that just backfired?
So we've spoken to many people who are in the former category, feel that it's a violation, as you put it, that it goes against the tenets of Islam, that Islam is very clear about the treatment of captives. It's clear about assault on civilians, non-combatants, and so on. Of course, we've also heard from people who, as you put it, are opposed to October 7th, not because they're opposed to killing Israelis, but because they are opposed to the damage it does to, that redounds back to Gazans. We've seen both types, but it's also important to take into account the whole of mirrors that is Hamas-dominated media and mass communications, because there are a great many Gazans who don't really know everything that you and I are aware of about what happened on October 7th. Tremendous disinformation campaigns have been waged, by the way, globally, but in inside Gaza, where Hamas media saturates the population, a lot of effort has gone into painting a picture very different from what actually happened. And a lot of Gazans were persuaded by that media that this was an attack on soldiers only.
Yeah, there's a point of view that, Hamas actually has carried out this act on with an intention of provoking Israel into what it's now undertaking, believing that the world will then take such a strong view against Israel that they will end up forcing Israel away from Gaza, and Hamas will eventually survive. And the people that have been lost don't really matter. The important thing is that Hamas will rise again after this war. That is what could very well happen.
Yes, it's a strategy that basically oriented toward galvanizing international public opinion against Israel at the cost of Palestinian civilians' lives, to apply pressure on Israel to accept a ceasefire arrangement that would leave Hamas in power. That's clearly their game, and they reason, it would seem, that this is a way to halt or arrest the progress that has been made in the direction of peace agreements between Israel and a growing number of Arab countries that view Israel as a natural partner in development and defense. Obviously, it's vital to demonstrate that this approach doesn't work. It's important as a matter of international security to discredit hostage taking as an effective means of warfare. It's crucial to anyone who's worried about the spread of hostage taking as a tool of war in any continent in the world, I think, is vested in seeing it fail on the part of the Hamas hostage-taking experiment here. It really must not yield political fruits for the people who perpetrated it.
You've been discovering that Gazans, in some cases, are not convinced that Hamas's rule can be ended, and that many believe that the war will conclude with a return to the status quo, some even fearing that if Hamas are to return to power, it'll be even more brutal than it was before, with harsh retribution against any suspected collaborators with the Israeli war effort. This outlook seems very bleak, so it seems imperative that Israel does succeed in removing Hamas from power. Otherwise, this scenario could very well unfold afterwards.
Well, we heard in one piece of testimony from the Voices from Gaza series, a woman say that she believes that if this war ends with a ceasefire and Hamas in power, that one of the things that Hamas will do will perpetrate a new October 7th, this time on the Gazan population itself, that they will perpetrate a massacre of anyone they even suspect collaborated with Israel or didn't adequately support Hamas. That fear is real. It's also there. I think that Gazans are rational in worrying that this war will end with Hamas in place. That is a very possible outcome. But I think that most of the people that we've spoken with are saying, as I've mentioned before, that the tragedy that we're seeing unfold today would be all the more tragic if it ends with the status quo ante. Then it really raises the question of why was this war fought at all, if not to change the fundamental reality of a terrorist organization governing a population with an iron fist, essentially terrorizing Gazans every day and Israelis every so often.
You've got other projects, Joseph, in your organization, like Jiran Productions, that aim to nurture brave artists, musicians, and filmmakers across the Middle East and North Africa who devote their talent to promoting an end to the conflict. Has your cooperation with these Arab Muslim communities been affected by what happened on October the 7th? Have you lost people? We found in Australia, just to illustrate my point, it's been almost impossible to find anybody here from the Muslim community who is prepared to take a side at all in support of Israel's position.
Well, let me say first that loss is a good way to describe one tragedy that affected one of our projects. We, before October 7th, we organized an art competition. It's called Array of Sight in English, A-R-R-A-Y, play on words, that had people coming together across borders of identity in the Middle East, including Israelis and Arabs, as well as Kurds and Arabs and Shiites and Sunnis and so on, to create art that conjures a vision of hope. And among the artistic collaborations that were submitted in this arts competition was one between an Israeli woman and an Egyptian graphic artist. The Israeli woman was among those killed in the Nova Music Festival on October 7th. And this was her last artistic project. It was a very visceral illustration for the community of Arabs and Israelis who participated in this bridge building arts competition of how there are people who want to build bridges and there are people who want to kill the people who want to build bridges. I don't believe that these atrocities or the war that followed have in any way changed the aspiration on the part of the wonderful people we worked with to seek peace. There is a climate of fear that has developed. It's always been there, but it's been exacerbated by the war. It has not changed the fundamental desire of the many people we're in touch with to seek a better way. We're quite active, and we have a number of new projects that we're planning to go public with quite soon.
Well, it really has been a great pleasure, Joseph, to talk to you again about your latest project, Voices in Gaza. And I certainly commend people to go back to take a look at your animated series, Whispered in Gaza, as well, because I think it still has a great deal of relevance. Thank you very much for talking to me once again on Israel Connection, Joseph.
My pleasure, David. Thanks for reaching out.